she can only do so much. She and the military have no trust with each other.
How can Myanmar resolve the Rohingya crisis? It's Thursday, September 14th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, refugee appeals hit snags in Australia. Protecting migrants from enforced disappearances. Scandalous sand in Cambodia. Healthy living and the death of a space probe. It's all on today's VOA Asia. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Wednesday the displacement of hundreds of thousands of members of Myanmar's Rohingya community can only be described one way.
Do you believe this is ethnic cleansing?
Well, I would answer your question with another question. When one-third of the Rohingya population had to flee the country, can you find a better word to describe it?
Nearly 400,000 predominantly Muslim Rohingyas have fled toward Bangladesh, which borders Rakhine State, where almost all of them live. At United Nations headquarters in New York, Guterres said Muslims of Rakhine State must be granted nationality, or at least for now, a legal status so they can lead a normal life.
I call on the Myanmar authorities to suspend military action, end the violence, uphold the rule of law, and recognize the right of return of all those who had to leave the country.
With concern growing worldwide about the situation in Myanmar's western Rakhine State, the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has canceled her original plans to travel to New York for annual UN General Assembly meeting beginning next week. The former Nobel Peace Prize winner, revered for her political campaign against the military junta that formerly ruled her homeland, has been criticized for a failure to do more to stop the current round of violence. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with David Steinberg, distinguished professor emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University, and was for 10 years director of Asia Studies there.
First, we have to understand the position of the Rohingya in the country, a name that the government will not use. They call them Bengalis. They refuse to use the term Rohingya. Rohingya consider themselves an ethnic group. They are not recognized by that by the government. The Rohingya say, we have been there forever, and I have coins in Persian from the 16th, 17th century indicating there were Muslims in that area at that time. But inside Myanmar, there is a very intense prejudice against Muslims. There's an ethno-nationalism which has come out, and it's you see this in parts of the monkhood. You see it and some riots that have taken place in other parts of the country, but is most concentrated on the Rohingya. And I have had sitting ministers in the government tell me things that you would not believe as being possible in the 21st century about these people. And they believe this stuff. This is the problem. And so you've got a situation that is very, very acute, that's widespread, and one is fearful that this will spread to other parts of the country as well. If that were to happen, and Mandalay, Yangon, and other places were to be under riots against the Rohingya, of the Muslims in general, then you would have martial law imposed, and the hopes of trying to get a more equitable, democratic, if you want to call it, that representative government in place in that country would be delayed for a long period of time. Now, what can Aung San Suu Kyi do? She runs a dual government. She has control of the legislature, not for changing the constitution, because the military can prevent that from happening, but the military control the rest of the government. They control three critical ministries, basically the elements of administration and coercion. They control the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Minorities, and the Ministry of Home Affairs. And the Ministry of Home Affairs controls the police and the bureaucracy throughout the country down to the local level. So she can only do so much. She and the military have no trust with each other. The first thing she should have done, I think, is to try and develop a level of trust, but instead she tried to outflank the military by creating the position of state counselor, which she holds, as well as Minister of Foreign Affairs. She says she's not a democratic icon, but a politician. She is a faded democratic icon in the international field, but she is a very inexperienced politician and has not done well internally. So the military don't trust her, and the outside world is waiting for her to do something significant to prevent these military incursions and the great depth of poverty and concern in that area. And the Rohingya are, I think, the worst-off people in East Asia.
Is there anything she can do about it?
The only immediate thing that could be done, which won't be done, is to say, all right, the UN should send in peacekeepers. The military would have to agree to that, but they won't agree to it. Kofi Annan led a commission to look into the problem, came up with some reasonable recommendations, but they can't be implemented now because of this militarization problem. So right now, we're stuck. To me, the world and Aung San Suu Kyi have to tell the military, this is something that will destroy you, the military's reputation in the country. It will prevent foreign investment. It will hurt your reputation. It will hurt the country. And so in terms of your own national interests, and these guys are patriots, however wrong they may be, you have to do something to alleviate the situation, which means getting your military under control and allowing foreigners to go in there to monitor the safety of the Rohingya. But that doesn't solve the problem. That just stops the killing or the exodus into Bangladesh at the moment.
David,
that's not going to happen.
David Steinberg, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Aung San Suu Kyi to skip upcoming UN General Assembly. Taiwan's activist subversion case pushes relations with China to another low. Under EU attack, top palm oil producers rethink trade strategy. China plans nationwide ethanol use by the year 2020. Maiden sighting of sperm whales in Pakistan. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more. They're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, check out the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Australia's federal court has challenged the way that an official refugee appeals panel handles evidence in some asylum cases. Judges have been examining why an Afghan Hazara man's claim for protection visa was rejected. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more.
Failings in Australia's system of reviewing appeals by failed asylum seekers have been exposed by an Afghan Hazara man who's taken his case to the federal courts. Judges criticised the Refugee Review Tribunal, the RRT, for refusing to accept that the Hazara man known as Syed, who's in his early 30s and has only one leg, was at any greater risk in his home country because of his disability. The court found that an RRT member who decided the man's case in 2013 had inserted three paragraphs from other asylum seekers' refugee applications. Thomas McLaughlin, Syed's lawyer, says the case against him was riddled with errors.
The RRT hearing had cut and paste errors in it from an unrelated decision. It referred to a 68-year-old person who was obviously not this applicant, who's not 68, and they relied on information relating to a completely unrelated person.
The tribunal's previous decision to reject the man's asylum claims has been overturned by the federal court. Judges said the RRT had failed to discharge its statutory functions. The panel, which is now known as the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, had been found to have used templates or cut-and-pasted information on separate asylum seeker applications several times. Syed's case will now be sent back to the tribunal for reconsideration. Australia currently grants refugee visas to about 16,000 people under official humanitarian programs each year. Canberra has also offered sanctuary to 12,000 refugees fleeing the conflicts in Syria and Iraq. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, South Korea says it has conducted its first live-fire drill for an advanced air-launched cruise missile to bolster its preemptive strike capability against North Korea. The Taurus missile, fired from an F-15 fighter jet, traveled through obstacles at low altitudes before hitting a target off the country's western coast. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for taking part of your day and spending it with us. UN experts say thousands of migrants are at high risk of enforced disappearance. A special report by the Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearance accuses states of the international community of turning a blind eye, and that generally goes unreported and unpunished. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on the report to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
The report finds a direct link between enforced disappearances and migration. In some cases, it says individuals may migrate because they may be at risk of enforced disappearance from their own governments, or they could be abducted during their journey for political or other reasons. It explains enforced disappearance can occur when a migrant is in detention or going through a deportation process. It can be a consequence of smuggling or trafficking. While the phenomenon is widespread, the vice chairman of the Working Group on Enforced Disappearance, Bernard Duhaime, tells VOA it is not possible to document its scale and scope. That is because the practice is hidden and takes place in secret. He adds it occurs in almost all parts of the world. For example, he notes cases of enforced disappearances in Libya and among refugees fleeing Syria.
There are similar instances in South Asia as well, in particular with the phenomenon of the migration of the Rohingyas. There are also examples, documented migrants crossing through Central America and through Mexico as well, who disappeared. The report refers to networks of traffickers and smugglers in Sudan and Eritrea, in that region as well.
Experts warn the increasingly dangerous routes migrants follow expose them to greater risk of becoming victims of human rights violations, including enforced disappearance. The report calls on governments to gather all information about people who disappear in or while transiting their countries and to do what they can to locate missing migrants. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia: Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi cancels plans to attend this month's United Nations General Assembly amid rising criticism of her handling of the violence in western Myanmar against ethnic Rohingya Muslims. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. An environmental group is highlighting huge discrepancies in Cambodian government data on exports of silica sand to Taiwan, in what the group's founder suggests may be a case of tax avoidance and economic fraud. Exports of another type of sand to Singapore were investigated after the same group exposed similar discrepancies in trade figures with that country last year. The group Mother Nature cited data from Taiwan's Customs Administration showing imports of 1.5 million tons of silica and quartz sand from Cambodia valued at more than $32 million between the years 2012 and 2016. But the group says Cambodia's Customs and Excise Department and the Ministry of Commerce records only show sales to Taiwan of about 29,000 tons during that period. The sand is used in making components for electronic devices and other products. VOA was able to examine Cambodian export records for all but 6 months of that period cited by Mother Nature and has verified its figures. The Taiwan import data is publicly available. Mother Nature's co-founder Alejandro Gonzalez-Davidson told VOA the figures are evidence of systematic fraud and pledged to pursue the case with anti-corruption authorities in Taiwan.
I'm hearing that the Taiwanese court judiciary system is independent of the executive branch, much more independent than in Cambodia and in Singapore. We're hearing that Taiwan has some pretty robust anti-corruption agencies and freedom of government information law. So we're going to exploit those, and we are going to try our best to get to the bottom of all this.
Cambodian government officials confirmed that any undisclosed exports of sand would normally have been subject to taxes, including royalties on resource extraction and a 20% tax on profits. Gonzalez-Davidson went further in an interview published Wednesday in the Phnom Penh Post, saying the sand sales could not have been hidden without government complicity. The Cambodian government says it has granted licenses to export silica sand to two companies, one owned by a senator who is close to Prime Minister Hun Sen. Prayup Kol, executive director of Transparency International Cambodia, said the Ministry of Economy and Finance and the Ministry of Mines and Energy need to investigate the trade figures to see if taxes were evaded.
It is not business as usual when it comes to such a huge amount of discrepancies, and it happened to be not one time, it's multiple times.
Officials at the General Department of Taxation, Ministry of Economy and Finance, and Ministry of Commerce either did not answer calls and emails or directed questions elsewhere. We thank Ralph Jennings in Taipei and Sun Naren in Phnom Penh, who contributed reports to this story. This news alert from VOA Asia: two baby Sumatran orangutans have arrived at Khao Prachab Chang Wildlife Breeding Center in Thailand. They'll stay there until a court case against their smuggler is completed. Orangutans, the world's largest tree-climbing mammals, are classified as critically endangered. All the big stories came your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, your social media posts and a different way of reading to young children are what VOA Asia's David Byrd has for us in today's edition of Healthy Living.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd in Washington, and this is Healthy Living. Do you have a Facebook page or an Instagram account? Did you know that what you post online could help your doctor know if you're depressed? Kevin Enix tells us how.
We live in the age of sharing. Events, great and small, moments, big and little, become chapters in the book of our online lives. It turns out some of the information you're sharing may be saying more about you than you think, says Chris Danforth via Skype.
Yeah, I think that, with so much more of our life happening on the internet these days and the ubiquity of mobile phones in our lives, there's just a lot more that we're revealing about our behavior maybe than we're even aware of.
The mathematician and his colleague Peter Dodds created some machine learning tools to analyze people's Instagram posts.
You know, people who had been diagnosed with depression, their pictures tended to be darker and bluer and grayer. If they chose to use a filter, it tended to be the black and white filter Inkwell. That's the one they chose more often than any others.
Danforth says it could lead the way to an app that alerts your doctor when you're in emotional trouble. There are also huge privacy concerns involved, and more research is needed to figure out how well machines can diagnose a human's state of mind. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Reading to your kids is one of the best ways to prepare them for a lifetime of learning. But as Faith Lapidus and Faiza El-Masri tell us, one Australian scientist is taking that a step further.
A personal experience motivated Chris Ferry to begin writing science books for these young readers.
He was in a bookstore for books for my kids and kind of naturally gravitated to the science section and noticed, well, there really isn't a science section for babies.
His books cover scientific concepts and topics for children from infancy to 10 years old in language they can understand. The Sydney-based physicist says his goal is to cultivate a passion for science in young kids. Ferry believes it's never too early to introduce children to science and technology.
At any point in time, they're going to be closer to a piece of technology than they are going to be to an animal or the topics that exist in children's books today. So I think it's more relevant to them.
Chris Ferry hopes his books will not only introduce young children to science, but will inspire them to become scientists. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
For more on these stories, visit voanews.com. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
The end of this week, we'll see the end of a glorious decades-long space mission that thrilled space scientists, sending huge amounts of data about a distant alien world. On Friday evening in Asia, the space probe Cassini-Huygens will descend into Saturn's atmosphere until it burns and disintegrates. VOA's George Pudich looks back at the achievements of the joint NASA-ESA mission.
It was 1997. Television was still in 3x4 format. A chess-playing computer beat a human chess champion for the first time, and the film Jurassic Park was stunning audiences. In NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, engineers were performing the final tests on a spacecraft, built jointly with a European space agency, ESA, to be sent on a journey of more than a billion kilometers. Named after two 17th-century astronomers, Giovanni Cassini and Christian Huygens, the spacecraft had two parts, a Saturn orbiter and a separate probe that was supposed to land on its moon Titan. During its 7-year journey to the sixth planet, the spacecraft made several flybys, including one that produced the most detailed color photo of Jupiter. In July 2014, the spacecraft finally entered orbit around Saturn, and in December, the probe, Huygens, separated from its mothership and landed on Titan, the first landing anywhere in the outer solar system.
I don't think you have to be a ring scientist to imagine what last night was for us. It was beyond description, really. It was mind-blowing. It was every adjective you could think of.
Cassini continued to orbit Saturn, discovering many more of its moons and sending back spectacular pictures of its rings. One of the things that stunned scientists was the discovery of water vapor geysers erupting from the south pole of Saturn's moon Enceladus, which pointed to a possible large, salty internal ocean. Scientists say they now know what to look for on future missions.
Is there evidence of biological activity in the plume of Enceladus, which would indicate there's life in its oceans? In my opinion, that is the most exciting, most thrilling question that we face in the exploration of the solar system now.
Scientists decided to destroy Cassini in order to avoid possible contamination of Saturn's moons with microbes from Earth that inevitably hitch a ride on all spacecraft. But before it disintegrates in Saturn's atmosphere, Cassini is expected to send the last and most spectacular close-up pictures of the gaseous giant. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
And you may follow the plunge of the spacecraft into Saturn's dense atmosphere live online. All you have to do is log on to saturn.jpl.nasa.gov. It's going to be quite an event, to be sure. It's quite an event for you to be with us. We thank you for joining us today on VOA Asia. Many of you have listened to our program live over many great radio stations in Asia, including DZUP 1602 AM Radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City, Philippines. Thank you so much for joining us. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, David Byrd, Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.